Court is in session.
Our next case for today is 2019-20140, Fulton v. United Airlines. Ms. Livingston.
Dana Livingston for the defendant's appellants, United Airlines and AirServe Corporation. In this personal injury case arising out of the claim that the plaintiff was dropped while being transferred from her seat aboard a United Airlines flight, a sizable judgment was entered.
Just one second. I seem to be getting either feedback or some discussions elsewhere. So if you're not speaking, and please put yourself on mute, and hopefully we can get this resolved so we can hear you well. Let's try again. You may proceed.
May it please the court. In this personal injury case arising out of the claim that the plaintiff was dropped while being transferred from a wheelchair into her seat aboard a United Airlines flight, a sizable judgment was entered. The bulk of that $3.8 million judgment, in fact, 94% of it, is for non-economic damages. I'm going to try to cover in the short time two issues. The first is whether the evidence of medical causation is legally sufficient, and second, whether the non-economic damages are grossly excessive, leaving to the brief other issues, including which exhibits actually went to the jury, unless the court has questions about those other issues. I'd like to go ahead and start with the medical causation issue. The plaintiff has a couple of problems here. The first one is that Fulton has a complicated and a pretty significant profile of pre-existing conditions.
That raises a very question that I want somebody to tell me about based on what the record shows. What is past disfigurement in this record? What is it and what's the evidence?
Normally it is something that mars the physical beauty. There was a definition supplied to the jury in the jury charge. It was in response to jury note number two. It's in our record excerpts. It's something that impairs the beauty or the symmetry of a physical appearance. Here there actually wasn't any testimony about that. Normally it's evidence of scarring or something like that. There was not actually a testimony about scarring other than Fulton's testimony that she had a significant scar from her cervical fusion surgery that was 4 years prior to this United Airlines flight.
Are there any pictures in the record?
There are not photos in the record except of her arthroscopic surgery. Those are at the tail end of the plaintiff's exhibits, but those are taken inside the shoulder. And so under Texas's approach to disfigurement, they shouldn't count. And it's not the way the jury was charged under the definition of disfigurement.
And you want to talk about pre-existing medical. Is
correct.
That right?
That's correct. So we've got several challenges for the medical causation evidence. One is this significant profile of pre-existing conditions that involved a lot of very painful conditions.
Wasn't the jury charged on that, though?
The jury was not. The PJC talks about an option to charge the jury about pre-existing conditions or...
The defendant asked to charge the jury on that?
It was not. The PJC guidance actually says that if the negligence question itself uses the word injury instead of occurrence, that it recommends that those extra instructions not be given. And so neither side requested.
You're free to argue that at the closing argument, though?
Correct. That's correct. So the problem really comes when we move over to Texas case law that talks about the character of evidence that's required for medical causation. And under this court's decision in Hamburger, we do look to Texas law about what that character of that evidence is in determining the legal sufficiency. And the Texas Supreme Court's been pretty clear that medical expert testimony is required if the causation is beyond the common knowledge or experience of laypersons. And that usually occurs when you have a plaintiff with pre-existing conditions that have some relevance to the damages that are being sought or sought to be recovered in a particular case. So that's when you end up with the Guevara case and the Jelinek case out of the Texas Supreme Court.
Didn't Ms. Fulton's doctor, Dr. Watson, I presume, didn't he testify that the injury was the result of trauma? It was the result of trauma and not a degenerative injury. It wasn't the result of a pre-existing condition.
So he didn't tackle head on a lot of her pre-existing conditions. And so there are two responses to your question. One is that some of his testimony is based on Fulton's own narrative. The other part of his testimony is at the end is that he tackles only whether it's a degenerative cause versus some sort of acute injury. And so what he doesn't know and what he admits that he doesn't know is whether this was some blunt force trauma or some other acute injury. And he certainly doesn't know when that might have happened.
What record evidence is there that suggests that it was her pre-existing condition that was the cause of what she suffered?
So this is the other answer to your question is, you know, we can have a pre-existing conditions might not hypothetically cause under Watson's view, Dr. Watson's view of it, right? Might not have caused the rotator cuff injury, but they have a significant relationship to the damages that she saw, which are the, you know, pain, physical pain and mental anguish, because she was already on round the clock prescription narcotic care for her various and serious, you know, debilitating conditions that are, you know, listed in our brief and they're in the record. You know, and one of the other problems with Dr. Watson is, you know, they never designated him as a retained expert and they never did disclosures for him as a non-retained expert. So they've got kind of this post hoc ergo propter hoc problem of Fulton's own testimony. They've got Dr. Watson relying in significant part on her recounting of events as part of his analysis. And then they're left without somebody who can testify about causation. But if you sort of set aside, you know, the non-retained expert issues, you know, Watson himself admits he can't say what caused it or when it was caused because of the passage of time. And he never goes in and rebuts really what our expert had said, which was that that 7 months after the injury, when you look at those arthroscopic photos, which is what Watson's relying on, is what he sees inside the when he does the surgery, that a blunt force trauma injury or an acute injury and a degenerative injury would actually look the same that many months out. I wanted to see if I could go ahead and shift gears a little bit to talk about excessiveness. So, you know, when I think about excessiveness, I'm mindful of Judge Rubin's admonition in Caldera that, you know, the sky can't be the limit and we need some sort of objective framework to analyze the excessiveness of damages. The plaintiff has spent some effort in her brief to invoke what I would call the unique facts exception to the maximum recovery rule. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the test for selecting analogous or benchmark cases for use as that objective frame of reference. The test under the maximum recovery rule for these benchmarks, it's not absolute identity, it's factual similarity. And so the plaintiff's unique facts exception argument appears to hinge on the presence of a bicep tear. The problem is that a couple things. The first is that her own treating physician, Dr. Watson, said that a bicep tear is common with a rotator cuff tear. And so the absence of the mention of a bicep tear in a particular opinion that might otherwise serve as a benchmark, I don't think the absence of the mention of a bicep tear is a reliable basis to exclude a case as a benchmark. You know, I think the other thing is that's where that the case that's addressed in the 28J letter, the Echeverry versus Jazz Casino case, is helpful. In that case, this court identified three case comparators that it said met the factual similarity test. And if you compare those cases and the facts about the injuries in those cases with the injury in the Echeverry case itself, you'll notice some differences. Nevertheless, the court said they are similar enough to be used as benchmarks, and it sends it back to the district court with instructions to use those cases as guideposts. And, you know, the plaintiff in that case actually raised the unique facts exception. It's not mentioned in the opinion, but it gets implicitly rejected. I mean, I think the lesson there is, you know, every case is going to be unique on some facts, that we ought not get too granular. The flip side, I think, of the search for benchmark cases is to not go too far afield of the injury and cast the net too broadly in trying to select a benchmark. And I think that's where Fulton's brief goes astray a little bit when it dips into these nursing home cases and other healthcare liability cases around page 43 of her brief. You know, in that pool of cases, none of those that she identifies actually involved a shoulder injury. I guess the purported similarity was that, you know, there was a negligent injury to someone who had a frailty. But, you know, as so often happens in these nursing home cases and other healthcare liability cases, these elderly or disabled claimants, the facts in those cases leading to the injury actually involve quite inflammatory facts. The other problem is I'm not entirely sure that the plaintiff wants to go there on those cases, because the Texas legislature has put caps down on healthcare liability claims. They did it in the late 70s in 4590I and then revamped them in 2013 as part of House Bill 4. And these days, for a live plaintiff filing a healthcare liability claim, the cap on all non-economic damage is $250,000. I mean, that's the public policy of the state of Texas about the limits of those. So, you know, I think it's a little bit of a risky gambit, not just because of the caps, but potentially it's an admission to large non-economic damages in this case. Like so many of those Med-Mal cases, may have been the product of inflamed passions. You know, so we end up, I think, with a little bit of a Goldilocks principle for the maximum recovery rule selection of cases, right? Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Avoiding the extremes and trying to find the common ground in selecting the benchmarks. I want to spend the last couple minutes here talking in particular about some of the, getting down into the weeds a little bit on some of the cases that both sides have cited. I think the primary factor in terms of the nature of the injury is a rotator cuff tear or shoulder injury. We've cited some of those cases in our opening brief, page 39 to 40. The plaintiff has cited an intentional injury case that did not involve a shoulder injury at all. It was a traumatic brain injury case. That's their Casas case, page 41 of the brief at note 6. That is not an appropriate benchmark. The injury is just quite different. We step back just a little bit and we think about the maximum recovery rule and some of the purposes for it. You know, I think in the old days, we used to think in valuing cases for purposes of settlement and just advising a client, you know, we'd use sort of a 3x medicals formula. If the facts were really extreme or the plaintiff was extremely sympathetic, maybe a 5x. But here, if we just assume that, what the jury awarded in past medicals is the right number. We're way over 30 times that amount. So I just think it's beyond the typical multipliers, and we end up being too far afield for the purposes of this court's maximum recovery rule jurisprudence.
Counsel, is it appropriate for the jury to have taken into account, though, the fact that she had to sit with this injury so long on the plane with no one noticing that she had been injured?
Right.
That it contributed to in the fact that she's always going to have pain. So both for the past and the future.
Certainly. We're not suggesting that her, in our excessiveness challenge, we're not suggesting that her damage award be zeroed out. And we have not challenged as a standalone challenge the handsome award of physical impairment, which goes to the part of your question, Judge Elrod, about that she will never be 100%. Even for the physical pain and mental anguish award, we're not suggesting that be zeroed out. We're suggesting that we use objective benchmarks to, consistent with this court's maximum recovery rule jurisprudence, to guide the district court on a remittiture of that amount to bring it within an appropriate range. And, you know, the flight itself was 25 minutes. Your point is well taken. Now, the issues about how long it took her to get some care afterwards and search for surgeons and stuff, I think then we start to get a little far afield, because there's certainly no tort for a failure to settle a personal injury claim. This is not a workers' comp case. It's not a bad faith failure to settle a first-party claim.
Okay, thank you. I think you've answered my question and your time has expired. Thank you very much. We'll hear from Ms. Nicholson.
My name is Penny Nicholson, and I'm here today representing the appellee, Erica Fulton. I want to answer some of the questions that the panel has already presented in terms of past disfigurement. The evidence was there were some small poke holes related to the surgery, and also there was bruising and swelling, and the record site for the bruising and swelling is ROA 0.1154. Then I'd also like to briefly address Judge Willett's point.
With that one? Do you think that, I mean, that's not, if we're frank with one another, that's rather thin for past disfigurement, isn't it?
Well, we've cited some case in our brief where $25,000 was awarded for scarring. The scarring, I think, may have been more significant, and if it's inflation adjusted, that would be around $50,000. But the past disfigurement is not our primary focus. But to Judge Willett's point about didn't the treating physician testify as to causation, that is exactly right, he did. That's in our first record excerpt and the record on appeal number 1331. And he testified very plainly that in reasonable medical probability, the accident, as Ms. Bolton had described it, was the cause of her rotator cuff injury. And the law in both Texas and the circuit is that treating physicians are allowed to testify as to causation, and that's what he did. The law is also that that a treating physician is entitled to rely on the history as provided to him by his patient and based on her medical records. So Dr. Watson was completely competent to provide that causation testimony, and he did. Given the clear nature of that testimony in the reply brief, the appellant said, well, that's just ipsy dixit. But that's not true either, because he went on for pages and pages describing why he concluded that the rotator, torn rotator cuff was caused by the trauma that resulted from her being dropped. And that's a lot of that.
Is there any evidence, is there any record evidence showing that your client, Ms. Fulton, had any shoulder issues before this incident on the plane?
No, there was no evidence of any shoulder injuries. And Dr. Watson specifically testified to that. And so there was no evidence of that nature.
Anything beyond Dr. Watson's testimony that kind of shows causation between the fall and the torn rotator cuff? Beyond his testimony, what else is in the record to amplify that?
Well, we are mainly, that's the testimony we're mainly relying on, and it's in record excerpt 2 and also pages 1309 through 1331 of the record. But I will note that when he was explaining, he said that there's two basic kinds of rotator cuff tears, and one is caused by trauma and one is caused by degeneration. And a rotator cuff tear that's caused by degeneration is characterized by fraying, and it's very thin when you look at it. A rotator cuff tear that's caused by trauma is, when you look at it, the rotator cuff still has its full thickness, but there is a hole or a tear that goes all the way through the full thickness of the rotator cuff. And he testified to that. And then, and so he said one of his primary reasons for concluding that the being dropped caused her rotator cuff tear was when he did the surgery, he looked inside her and he could actually see that there was a hole there that went all the way through the rotator cuff, and he did not see evidence of degeneration. And when you're saying other evidence, their expert, Dr. Elia, had to admit that there was a full thickness rotator cuff tear. And what that meant is the doctor that they had been relying on, Dr. Finkel, he's not an expert, he's someone she saw, he thought, well, you know, I think this is just caused by radiating pain from her shoulders. I don't think she needs surgery. And I think it's coming from her neck. Well, contrary to what the appellant said in their brief, Dr. Watson did consider that. He, in pages 1401, 1402 of the record, he says, you know, I saw they had concerns about, does this come from the neck? And he looked at that, but he disagreed with their opinion. And so another piece of evidence that kind of supports the causation is that one of the other things that Dr. Finkel had said was that surgery is not going to do her any good. She's not going to feel any better after the surgery. It's radiating from her spine, radiating from her neck. But what happened was that after the surgery, she'd been in excruciating pain for 7 months before the surgery, and she began to get better in terms of her pain after the surgery. So there you can see also is evidence of causation. And she didn't get all the way better. She still has pain. She still has limitations. But for the first time, she had some relief. So that's primarily the key evidence that we're relying on in terms of causation. Let's see. Turning to...
Is there also testimony that she had full use of her arms before the accident and that she had no pain the day before the accident. So that till after, that's not necessarily a hostile question, but is the evidence in the record from Ms. Fulton and her caretaker that she had full use before this accident, but not full use after the accident? Is that in
the record? Oh, yes, that's definitely. Yeah, because her arms were in good shape. She had to use, because she was confined to a wheelchair, she had to use her arms. And that's one of the reasons why this case is so different from other cases when you have a rotator cuff tear. For an able-bodied person, or a person, even just a person who had the use of their other three limbs, it would not be anywhere near as traumatic an injury. But for her, she basically lost the use of three limbs and was only left with one, and that was her non-dominant arm. So she lost her mobility, she lost her independence, and it was a way worse injury than it would be. Like in the typical rotator cuff cases that the appellant cite, it's just not comparable. They're nothing alike. She's in a much worse situation than those people are. Actually, in terms of comparable cases in the injury, we don't think there are any analogous cases in this court. And we do think this case falls within the uniqueness exception. But we think that the most analogous case is actually the Rehabilitation Hospital of Austin versus Cooper case. Now, that is a case about from a nursing home, but the woman was injured when she was being moved from her bed to a wheelchair. And the injury was she got two broken legs in that. And so there is a different nature of the injury in that sense. But both plaintiffs suffered excruciating pain. And in addition to that, they were both people who had very circumscribed lives to start with. And in the Cooper case, the appellants had suggested, look, in light of this woman's limited mobility, come on, give me a break. $1.25 million is way too much. And that would be adjusted to with inflation today, about $2 million. And the court came back and said, no, that's not right. You know, what you did to this woman is you took away what little hope and independence she had. And the small things that she enjoyed that if someone else had them taken away, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But for this plaintiff, it is a big deal. And that's really the same kind of situation that Ms. Fulton is in. And we're not saying it's exactly analogous, but we think it's the most analogous because, I mean, it's just not the same thing, the cases that are cited with rotator cuff tears. And the maximum recovery rule provides that, the recovery is limited to 150% of the highest comparable case, but they're just not a comparable case here. In fact, I say that if the uniqueness exception doesn't apply here, it doesn't really exist. I mean, this really is different from other cases. And there are cases, it's true that as the appellants have pointed out, that most of the time there are analogous cases, but there isn't here. And there are cases that have applied the uniqueness exception. The Bogler case that we cited, and then also there is a case, the Laramont versus Sears Roebuck case, which is 631 F3rd 724. It's a case from the Fifth Circuit from 2011. What they looked at in these cases seems to be a constellation of injuries and whether there's comparable cases involving the constellation. And we submit that in this case, they're not comparable. There's no comparable cases.
Did when these arguments were presented to Judge Hittner, and I know that they were in part of a new trial and a remittiture and all kinds of things that were filed before him, did he, I know he ruled on the on those motions in an order, but did he address them in a hearing or something where he considered what he thought was comparable or why he did what he did? I should know that, and I just don't.
I don't believe that he did. I think that his written orders were in body.
Right, and I'm not saying that, that's insufficient in any way. I'm just wondering, because obviously he's a very experienced, both Texas and federal judge with plaintiff personal injury cases. So, okay, thank you.
The other thing about the mention of passion and prejudice is I don't think that that's where this jury was going at all. And the basis for that is all these notes that they sent out. I think that this was a very conscientious jury. Before the deliberations had barely started when they said, oh, there's some typos here. And about, I think it had to do with the numbering because it's not even included in a note, but they were really laser focused on what they were being asked. They sent out, I think, three questions relating to please define the damages for us. There was not a mental anguish definition in the jury charge originally, or the court's instructions originally. And so they said, can you help us and give us a definition? And by agreement of the parties, they did. They also asked about what does disfigurement mean? They asked about physical impairment. So they were very focused on getting this right. They deliberated over 2 days. There were three questions, but they had more subparts. But this was a very conscientious jury, the kind of jury you want that does want instructions. So I don't think it was the result of passion or prejudice. And as a number of cases note, different juries evaluate these very subjective injuries in different ways. And I think, I know there's the comment about, well, the disfigurement, they didn't award any damages for future disfigurement. So they were applying a reasoned analysis of the questions. And, you know, I think they were trying to answer them to the best of their ability, being extremely conscientious.
Remind us how these numbers compare to what was argued by plaintiffs or defense counsel in their closing arguments.
I think in the closing arguments, no specific damages amounts were suggested for the individual individual elements of damages.
Thank you.
Let's see here. Let's see. And then, in terms of bicep tear, I think that it's just speculation about whether these other injuries, these other cases involve bicep tears, but I still think that really it needs to be viewed in the larger picture of what effect this had on Ms. Fulton, and as opposed to some of these more picky details, because there was very strong evidence in the record of her pain and her disability. Her caretaker testified, and she testified that the pain was just excruciating, that this was a woman who was used to pain. She had this degenerative spinal injury, so she was used to coping with pain. But the shoulder injury, what turned out to be a full thickness rotator cuff tear, took the pain to a whole new level. Both Ms. Fulton and Ms. Tamarga, the caretaker, said they couldn't even describe how intense this pain was. Another indicator of how traumatic that this was for her is that Ms. Tamargo saw her right before she left and helped her get on, go to the airport. and saw her right when she came back. And she was immediately saw that something terrible had happened. It was like a different person had come. And she's noted that Ms. Fulton had worked very hard to be as strong as she could be and healthy as she could be, so she could be as independent as she could be. And all that was basically taken away from her by this accident. Ms. Tamargo described her as having been emotionally devastated by everything that happened to her. And another indication of how painful this all was the only reason to get this surgery is, or the main reason to get it, is to alleviate pain. Her pain was so great that she went to, and it's not easy for her to do things like this. She went to all the trouble to get the surgery. She had to go through a number of doctors who were basically saying, oh, don't bother us with this, it's just your back. And then she finally found one that took her seriously, and it turned out he was right. Even their own expert had to admit that he was right about it being a full thickness rotator cuff tear. Now, he did not agree with Dr. Watson more generally. And to get this, she had to, then one of the reasons why it occurred 7 months later was she had to go through all kinds of having therapy, getting the money arranged, finding doctors. And also, I also don't want to omit that Dr. Watson testified that she will need additional rotator cuff surgery in all reasonable medical probability. And that's because partly because of how much she has to use her arms, because of she just only moves around and navigates by wheelchair. And also that he said rotator cuff surgeries generally don't last forever and they basically wear out over time. So we ask that the court affirm the judgment. Thank you very much.
I make a few quick points. Judge Elrod, you asked about closing argument. No specific amounts were listed for the jury during closing argument by plaintiff. There was an Elmo. The record, the transcript shows in brackets that the numbers were being written. Something was being written on the Elmo. It just says open parentheses indicating several places during closing argument when Fulton's counsel is talking about how much ought to be awarded for the non-economic portion of the damages elements that were being submitted to the jury. That's the same passage in which the send a message to the corporation. And if you want the message to the corporation to go high, to this person, to this person, to this person, that the amount you award needs to be several, a multiplier of the amount that's otherwise necessary to fairly compensate her. So, that's what was said in closing to answer your question about that. In pretrial conference, which was, I guess, the Friday before the trial started on Monday, Judge Hittner did ask plaintiff's counsel, what are you seeking here? And plaintiff's counsel responded, I'm trying to get $80,000 in medicals and $500,000. So that is what he described as, I guess, his best day as you were headed into trial. I guess it gives me some pause about whether her compensatory damages are somehow more than 6.5 times sort of the best day between the final pretrial conference and closing argument. I want to answer the question. There were some questions about all the evidence about loss of enjoyment of life. That issue, diminished physical capacity, not being back up to 100%, and loss of enjoyment of life. And there was a lot of testimony about that. That all goes under physical impairment. There's a footnote in the Longoria opinion out of this court from 2019 that confirms that that's the case under Texas law as well. And the problem here there's with Watson's testimony, if I could shift to that for a second, is sort of twofold. there's our causation challenge, but there's the problem that the jury was left with sort of insufficient guidance about how to determine, what her level of physical pain and mental anguish is. And that's the biggest portion of that non-economic damage award. It's the $3 million between the past and the future. That's ends up not being, his testimony ends up not being enough under Texas law. And that's why that, is important in this case.
Is it legitimate for the jury to have considered a future surgery in its damage award?
Absolutely. That goes into the future damages awards, and it goes into, the pain and mental anguish from having to do that would go into that $3 million. It was $1 million for future. The inconvenience and diminishment goes under the physical impairment. Any disfigurement they didn't award for future there. And then there's a separate future award for future medicals. There's an instruction to not overlap, to not award damages in more than one category that was also given to the jury as part of the answer to jury note number two. So I guess my last point really kind of has to do with the caution that we ought to use about picking sort of an outlier or picking cases that aren't quite factually similar. I do think that the maximum recovery rule allows for a court to make some calibrations and some adjustment once it finds a case that involves a factually similar injury. And again, I think that's where there's a role here for that physical impairment award, where we don't have a standalone damage to the $525,000 physical impairment award that covers loss of enjoyment of life and diminished physical capacity or physical, your functionality and things like that. I just thought I would leave the court with just a couple of reflections from Judge G and his opinion in U.S. v. Wheat about the exercise of judgment when you're reassessing a damage award. Of course, it's subjective, but it involves the interplay of experience, emotions, and calculation, all within an objective frame of reference, damage awards in similar cases. And so to avoid the danger of sort of this arithmetic progression of $1.5 million, this $3.8 million award stands the new benchmark. The next such case ends up being $5.7 million, the next one $8.5 million. I think that pushes us to be very cautious and choosy about the benchmarks.
Thank you. We have your arguments. We appreciate y'all both appearing by Zoom today so we could hear from you in your case and the cases submitted. Thank you.